I feel like I'm in handicapped or something. I need this. But thank you. Are the lights going to go off and on? First of all, I'm going to tell you, I feel a little uncomfortable going after Mr. Luker. I'm very traditional about senior man speaks last, first time, all the time. So I'm a little uncomfortable. Mr. Weber, this is technically his message, and we wanted to have a live and semi-awake voice after the message, because it was an important message that was given before the Council of Elders, really prior to their meetings this week, which were, I guess, a little uncomfortable for what happened, but you can read about them in the letters on the information table. For Mr. Luker's sermon, I agree. And whereas no man speaks for me, I agree. So, if you wonder what I think, listen to the video again. Today, though, I want you to put on your smock, a goggles, set of goggles and some gloves. In the Bible study, we had a little bit of a chemistry experiment. We're going to have another one today, chemistry 2. What we're going to be talking about today, just as we did in the Bible study, which was on James 4, we're going to be talking about in Ephesians 4, which has some very similar topics to James 4. Also has some similar topics to what we heard from Mr. Luker as well. So one would hope, one would pray that we're all thinking hopefully somewhat of the same thing. So as a chemist, as I told the Bible study group, the ingredients that we're going to be handling, we need to handle diligently, carefully. They produce profound and lasting results. Mishandled, they can cause great damage. I need to do a segue, I almost forgot. Thank you, children. That was a wonderful, wonderful piece. I was singing it, and I had to stop singing it on the way up, so I lost my train of thought. I apologize. So thank you all very much. Thank you, Caitlin. Thank you, Sharon. That was wonderful. So, sorry, segue. In handling these components, they produce results. Now, there are many different types of chemical reactions. There's some starting components where results are made and you can never go back. There are those that basically can go either way. And some are in an state of equilibrium where they change back and forth. A good example of an equilibrium reaction, very simple one, is boiling water. You can boil the water, right? It starts to evaporate into the air. You can reverse the situation by putting a lid on it, and the condensate goes back into the water. You can change its state and go back to, if you had ice cubes in the water, you can put it in the freezer. And that's a reversible reaction. But many reactions, there's no going back, like making a bomb. You put the bomb together, you detonate it, you ain't putting the pieces back together again. Baking a cake. Those of you that bake cakes, you can't put the eggs back in the shell. You can't put the mix back in the box. You can tell how many cakes I make. You can't put the ingredients back to their original form. It only goes one way. But sometimes, in rare cases, we can manipulate the pressure or the outside factors, and we can indeed reverse a reaction. A reversible reaction is hardest to control. In fact, it's uncontrolled. To drive it to its ultimate desired result takes great planning. It takes great discipline. And, you know, in the opening prayer, Mr. Black's opening prayer, I couldn't have asked for a segue, because today we're going to be talking about and discussing the aspect of the chemistry of unity. So if you turn with me to Ephesians chapter 4, I think this is an important chapter. It's a very sane chapter. But there is an aspect of unity that is important that has to do, I think, with some chemistry. It has to do with the way things are put together, the way things are handled. It's important, while we read this, to think of the ingredients, what we call the reactants, the accelerators, the catalysts, things that can speed up the reaction, things that can inhibit the reaction. I want you to think of it like a chemist. We have a couple in the room, and I've sought the expertise of one of our members whose chemistry is far greater than mine. Mine is old, dated, and I was going to yank out all my glassware and set it up here on the podium, and I couldn't find it. That's how old it is. I put it in a box. I don't know. I don't even know where it is. So I sought the expertise, and you hear that expertise occasionally through the message here. So chapter 4, verse 1 of Ephesians. Paul says, I, therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling with which you were called, with all lowliness and gentleness, long-suffering, bearing one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There is one body, one Spirit, just as you were called in one hope of your calling. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in you all. He puts a lot in these verses. He puts a tremendous amount. If you were baking a cake and these were all the ingredients, you're putting together a chemical reaction, it's a lot of ingredients, a lot of reactants. There's a lot of variables. We look at verse 1 and he says, I am a prisoner, he says, of the Lord. He says, I beg you, beseech you, to walk worthy of the calling with which you were called. To walk there means your comportment. It's an old word. He has or she has comportment. They are aware of who and what they are and what they believe. It's what you are occupied with in the original Greek. The word worthy means that you are appropriately and deservingly and fittingly given. It's appropriate. You are worthy of the things that you've been given because you have an invitation. Paul in Ephesians calls it a calling, a call from God. The vast majority of the people in this room are called of God. We believe that our children, the little ones that were up there that sang so beautifully, this church teaches that God is calling his children. He calls them, and he calls them through us. We have all been given an invitation from God, and we are to understand that we have this special invitation from him to act in a certain way, to think and to do, not as robots, not as automatons, not all as yellow pencils, for we are not all yellow pencils, but we're to do so with awareness and deep understanding. There is a gravity to the calling that we have. Mr. Luker was very careful in the words that he chose in the beginning of his message, and this won't be a running commentary on his message, but you could see the deliberate, the tactical, the deep concern over the words that he used. There is an understanding of our calling. Calling as members, and for those of us that are ordained, calling as an elder. We take it very, very seriously. But now that we have this calling, what do we do with it? How do we walk this walk? Let's read verse 2. He says, with all lowliness and gentleness, long-suffering, bearing one another in love. There's a lot there. The lowliness literally means low-minded. We talked in the Bible study about humility. We talked about the world. We talked about in James, where James talks about the pitting of the love of the world and the world's ways and the jealousy that God has for us when we depart from him and draw toward the world. The wealth and the power, the entertainment industry, the sexuality of the world in which we live. And brethren, this church is located right in the middle of it. I can remember when I would go overseas and they would ask, what church do you attend? And I would say, Eagle Rock? Well, they wouldn't know that. They may know Pasadena. So after a while, I'd just say, Hollywood. Hollywood. Because that's what people think of in Southern California. We live right in the middle of it. It is not a humble area. But he says that we are to have lowness of mind, gentleness, which means consideration and kindness. We're to have long-suffering. This is a very interesting word. In the original, it's a cognate of macrothrumos, which means distant anger. That anger is put far away from you, from us. God's word tells us to be, we can be, angry, but don't sin. Brethren, I get angry. And I often sin because of that anger. God says don't do that. He says to put anger distantly. I usually get angry at things rather than people. Printers, computers, right? Blackberries, right? They're evil anyway, so I don't think God is mad at us for being angry with those. Anger will happen. It's a natural thing. But Paul says to contain it. One commentator said it's almost like pillow anger. You know what pillow anger is? Ladies will know what that is. I see a couple of heads nodding. So when you get really angry and you scream, what do? You put a pillow over your head and then you scream, right? So no one can hear it. We don't do it to one another. He says to have this gentleness, this lowliness, this long-suffering. And then he says to bear one another. It literally means to hold up one another, maintaining something up. And he uses the word in love. Now there's three, as you know, there's three words for love in Greek, three primary words. This one is not phileo. It is not eros. It is this agape love, this very deep, godly love that is used throughout so much of the New Testament. It is this long-suffering and bearing one another in love. So that's what we do and how we do it. And the actions that you see here are mainly outward. Outward. We bear one another in love is an outward expression. We have lowliness of mind, that's inward. But it's what we do toward one another that Paul is trying to get across here. We are gentle. We are long-suffering. Some could say patient. We lift up one another. Verse 3, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. It's almost like a formula here. It's almost like a chemical formula. When we add the understanding of our calling, the lowliness or humility of our mind, gentleness, distant anger, and holding up in love, what is the result? It's very specific. It's what we think inside, what is deep inside our heart, and how we express it. It produces something. Now, to most people that you would express that to, one would think it would be a kind and gentle reaction. And in fact, that's what God tells us. He says it produces the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. But we're missing something in that formula if we put the Spirit on the result side and we don't put it on the product side. So when you add the understanding of who we are, humility, gentleness, distant anger, holding one another in love, the world does that. The world does that. I have friends and coworkers, and you do too. They're very gracious. They're very humble. They're very helpful. They love to serve other people. But what drives us is very different. We do so with the unity of the Spirit. It is God's Spirit that makes all the difference. It makes us different than the rest of the world. It gives us all the great discernment of these ingredients in this formula. It helps us understand just exactly what God is trying to put across when we speak and the way we react to one another, and by extension with the people outside the church of God, to everyone. The formula that's missing with the world is God's Spirit. And what does it produce? The goal, the result? What's the product, the end of the formula? What is it trying to make, as it were? It's trying to make the bond of peace. So we add all these things together, and it creates the bond of peace. Brethren, I want peace. I read the paper, there is no peace. I watch the news, there is no peace. Not in Washington, not in London, not in Jerusalem, not in Korea, not in South America. There's no peace in the world. So what I read and what I see, just like you do, there's no peace. But Paul says that we are to have this great bond of peace. Bond, by the way, is a chemical term. We'll deal with that in a minute. Peace is what we desire. Christ said in John, "Peace I leave with you. My peace I give you. I do not give you as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled, and do not be afraid." You know the rest of that verse. This is that peace that he talks about. This calm understanding that we know our calling, that God has forgiven us, makes one very humble, doesn't it? It makes one very humble when we think of why we're to be humble. because God has done so much for us. Peace is what God desires as a goal. The attributes added with God's Spirit that we talked about, all those things produce a bond. In chemical bonds, there are many different types of bonds. Chemical bonds hold this pulpit together. They hold this light together. By the way, they hold you together. And there are many, many different types of bonds. I remember the very first message that I think I ever gave. It was a sermonette. And I always instruct the sermonette givers, always speak about something you know about, that you're an expert on. There's got to be something that you are either trained, educated, familiar by experience, that you know, and you know it. Speak on those things. Well, that advice was given to me, and I was a chemist. Chemical bonds, that's what I'll speak on, and that's what I did. There are many different types of chemical bonds. There is the covalent bond. It's a covalent bond, carbon to carbon. There's ionic bond, your table salt, sodium to chlorine. There are nuclear bonds. In fact, most bonds are nuclear. They're at the atomic, subatomic level. They, in most cases, are immovable and inseparable. That's why we have what's called a fissionable event, also known as an atomic bomb. It's where those bonds are split, and you need atoms and an accelerator going at unbelievable speeds to shatter the chemical bond, these nuclear bonds. These bonds cannot be broken except from a strong outside force, but there is a bond. There is a force that is much, much more powerful. Bullets cannot break this bond. Not words and not deeds, not really. It can't destroy this type of bond. It is the bond of peace through God's Spirit. It is unbreakable. How can it be breakable if it is of God? It is impossible. It cannot be broken if this formula is used. These words that we read in Ephesians, we call them Holy Writ. They're given by God through Paul to the church of Ephesus. He gives us a formula, and I doubt that Paul knew that someone would try and interpret this as a chemical formula. But all these ingredients are important, and it produces a result, this bond of peace. It is God's Spirit that gives us this glue. It is all that we have of this glue. It is the most important. It is what fuses us together. We may like each other. We may appreciate one another's company. We may be long, long friends. We may be family members. But the bond that is stronger than all of that is God's Spirit. God's Spirit is indeed almost like an accelerator. It's like a catalyst that moves this thing forward. All those ingredients can exist in the world, but without the accelerator and this added ingredient, it really isn't the same. This expertise that I sought out of a member whose chemistry is greater than mine, they said, in fact, I would posit that if we only allow the worldly inhibitors into our reactions and do not embrace God's Spirit and allow His grace to humble us, then it can indeed become an uncontrollable reaction. Now, when a chemist says uncontrollable reaction, that is like a runaway freight train that doesn't need the track. It is one of the worst expressions that a chemist can hear. How's the reaction going? Oh, it's uncontrollable. That's not a good thing. It's a horrible thing. I think it was well said. Say it again. If we do not embrace God's Spirit and allow His grace to humble us, then it can indeed, these ingredients, become uncontrollable in its reaction. We walk in our calling for a desired result. Anything other than that is unacceptable. We have an expectation that when we apply these factors, all of these factors, plus God's Spirit, we should, with this unity, achieve this bond of peace. If indeed, in chemistry, you do not achieve the result that you seek, and you're following the formula, and the formula is tried and is true, something is wrong, and it's not with the chemistry. It's the one putting it all together. It's the one applying it. Something was mixed out of proportion. If we don't exercise these traits, bad things happen. Let me give you an example. We go back to cooking. I don't cook much, but I do know how to cook some things. I know that when I don't follow the recipe, right? Let's say I'm making banana bread, and I put together my milk and eggs and flour and some leaven and maybe a little bit of flavoring. Am I going to get banana bread? No. What did I leave out? The bananas. When you leave out any ingredient, you do not get the desired result. My wife has recipe books. There's a whole shelf, maybe it's two shelves, of recipe books. These are very, very valuable. I went out this week and saw a book stand. My son and I were out and we saw a book stand. It's a beautiful wrought iron book stand. It's not any book stand. Guess what kind of book stand it is? It's a recipe book stand. So she can, I know, pretty cool, huh? You set the book in, it holds it open to that page. Why do you want that page? I want that recipe. Why do you want that recipe? I want that desired result. I want what it's talking about. Therefore, I follow the instructions. Can you change it? Sure, but you'll get a different result. You must follow the recipe. All these things are important. If we do not exercise the traits that Paul talks about here, small things will break the unity. Small things will be allowed to break this bond of peace. Maybe it's the words of others, ill-timed actions. They will not allow us to withstand if that's what it takes to disrupt us. If little things, little changes, and some of us have to decide what's small and what's not. It will destroy great things. Do you know that in certain chemical reactions, you need to have what's called 4/9 pure ingredients? That is ultra, ultra pure. That was in my day. In my day, 4/9 pure was very expensive, very hard to obtain, but unbelievably necessary. Do you know what they need now? 6/9, 99.99999% pure, ultra pure. Because any imperfections in that formula will change the result. So these motives and these intentions have to be pure. Humility has to be pure. Long-suffering has to be pure. God's Spirit, it's got to be His Spirit. And now we can read verses 4 and 5 with a little more understanding. He says, there is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called in one hope of your calling. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in you all. There's seven ones there. Very complete. Seven ones. There is only one. There are things that unite us, and there will be things that divide us. But he goes on, how do we do these things? He says in verse 7, but to each one of us grace was given according to the measure of Christ's gift. Therefore, he says, when he ascended on high, he led captivity captive, and he gave gifts to men. Verse 9, now this, he ascended. What does it mean but that he also first ascended into the lower parts of the earth? He who descended is also the one who ascended far above all the heavens that he might fulfill all things. That's a parenthetical remark. We want to talk and focus on he gave gifts. Grace is given as a gift due to Christ's gift. What is it? It is Christ's sacrifice. It is the unmerited pardon when we accept his sacrifice that we are given grace, favor, concession, forgiveness. And who is he speaking to? He's speaking to all of us. He's speaking to the entire church at Ephesus. He leaves no one out. He speaks to you, and he speaks to me. If we have repented of transgressing God's law and accepted Christ's sacrifice, we are no longer a captive to anything. He led captivity captive. Nothing can hold us. Christ tells us no one in John chapter 10, no one can pluck him from his hand, can pluck us from his hand, nor can they pluck us from God's hand. No one. It says in verse 11, and he himself gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers. Now, it's interesting, just a quick comment. These are offices, and they are semi-specific. In many other cases, elders are called bishops or overseers. There are no hard and fast, people wish that there were, there are no hard and fast definitions or words that were used in the Greek New Testament. But these that are used, and we'll use them. But I want you to understand that these are more than people, and they are far more than positions. These offices are really not nouns. They are verbs. Why? Apostles go forth. Prophets prophesy the future. Evangelists evangelize, speaking the good words of the gospel. That's what evangelists do. Euangelio, which means preach the good news, words that are good. Pastors shepherd, that's what the word means. Teachers teach God's word. That's all they do. The words are, in many cases, interchangeable with others in the New Testament. And I've been ordained, brethren. Danny Luker's talking about when he was ordained. I think I was ordained at 29. So I'm a couple years behind him. But I'm many, many years behind him. I'm the lightweight that speaks to you today. I've only got 29 years. So all those years, I've never seen it as a position. It just isn't. It's a verb, not a noun. It says in verse 12 that we have a duty. It says there are these people in the church, and this is their sole reason for being ordained to these positions, for the equipping of the saints for the good work of ministry, of serving. Servants do one thing and one thing only. They serve. They serve for the edifying of the body of Christ till all come to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God. That is the goal. That is why we edify. That is why we teach. That is why those pastor. It is what we do. It is not what we are. Do you know that elders aren't elders unless there's a congregation? I don't believe this is the Navy, that you're a captain for life. It doesn't make any sense. To me, a captain without a ship, they're not a captain. I'm a captain. Well, you got the uniform, you got the nice hat, and you got the pretty shoes. Where's your boat? I haven't got one right now. No. Elders are to serve. That's all they're ordained to do. We have a duty. It is to give service of preparation, relief, to serve is what the word means. It's not so much an office. It's what we're called to do. Whatever gifts we are given, the objectives of the verse is the same. It is the edifying of the body. The edifying of the body is the goal. Till we all come to the unity of the faith, verse 13, and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect or mature man. A perfect or a mature man. That is why we edify, or try and edify you. It says that this knowledge of the Son of God, this perfect man, is an interesting set of verses. A perfect man or a woman. And we serve to bring you to that maturity, as Mr. Luker said, very imperfectly. We're very imperfect, brethren. We do things that we shouldn't do. We say things we shouldn't say. We allow you to see things you shouldn't see. There's no attempt to hide, but elders are not to serve other elders. Elders are to serve the brethren. It goes this way, not this way. When we are ordained, we are not ordained to serve one another. We are ordained to serve you. We do so as assistants, as it were, to the bride. We are merely assistants. Verse 14, that we should no longer be children, tossed to and fro, and carried about with every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men and the cunning craftiness of deceit, plotting, but speaking the truth in love. Mature, not children. We want you mature. Becky and I have children, three children, that we kind of borrow from God. They don't belong to us. They belong to God. Brethren, father is not a noun. It is a verb. Father is a noun, not a verb. When you father someone, just as you would mother someone, it's because we think of what they do, not who they are. Mothers are known and fathers are known by what they do, not who they are. It says that we are to do these things so that children are not children anymore, but they are mature adults, not carried about by every wind of doctrine or the trickery of men, cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting, but speaking the truth in love, that we all may grow up in all things unto him who is the head, Christ. Head is Christ. Verse 16, and from whom the whole body joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. Every part does its share. I'm supposed to do my part, and you need to do your part. I need to use these formulas, and you do too. Let's read it again. The body, verse 16, from whom the whole body, which is Christ, the body of believers, and Christ is the head, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies. You are a bunch of joints. Yeah. I'm a joint. You're a joint. We all fit together to form the body. We all have a function. What is the goal? What is the product that we're trying to manufacture? It causes growth of the body for the edifying, the lifting up of itself. Who lifts up you? We do. We lift one another up. We edify one another. It's self-reflective. And every part does so in love. This chemistry of Ephesians contains specific formulas. It has ingredients that we just should not take lightly. They all serve a purpose. The patience, the humility, the loving kindness, the upholding in love. And there are many others. And they must be additive. They cannot subtract. They must accelerate. They cannot let the reaction go the other way. They must go forward to edifying of the body. Formulas are critical. No ingredient can ever be left out or you will not get the result that God wants. In chemistry, formulas are sacred. They are the holy grail of a business. They are protected and guarded. They are covered and triple guarded and covered under lock and key in big vaults. That's where ours were. They were in a vault. We always had originals. Originals. And it was in a day when there was electronic copies, and the electronic copies were also kept in the vault. Sign them in, sign them out. We wanted to know where they were. They were that valuable. Because you know what? These formulas worked. They had been worked over and over and over again and perfected. They produced the result we wanted time and time and time again. And some of them are extremely complex. 10, 15, 20 steps, 30, 40 different ingredients. They all had to be followed in order. Well, let's see, Bob. Harry, what did you say the last time we did this? It was none of that. You hauled it out, you reviewed it, and you performed it. They were sacred. Whether it's a drug or a paint, whether it's anything that's made, anything that you have in your home, there was a formula that put it together. It's like a recipe. The food you eat all comes from a recipe. We see the ingredients on the side, but it's how they're put together. It's how they're manufactured that is the secret, and you'll never know that. It's called a trade secret. That's the recipe. Formulas are designed for a purpose, to produce a beneficial or expected result. No one ever puts together a formula not expecting a specific result. And so we have this in Ephesians. The bonds of the reactants are broken. They're put together and then broken to reform something else, something better. Humility becomes something better. Humility with God's Spirit becomes something better. And this is what Ephesians says to us today. We are about the business of creating bonds of deep and lasting and spiritual relationships that cannot ever be broken, cannot ever be stretched to the point of breaking, that nothing will drive us apart, nothing will separate us. Because, brethren, the bad stuff is yet to happen. The prophecies are yet to happen. Please read Ephesians 4, study the formulas, and then apply them.